This is Discovery 2, Module 2. Okay, today we're going to talk about the basic functions of an internet service provider, or more specifically, the services that an internet service provider is supposed to provide but often doesn't, and why you would pick another internet service provider as a result. This is important because if you are going to work for an internet service provider, you need to be able to know what is supposed to happen and what you're supposed to do so that you can keep your customers. As we discussed last week, I believe, an internet service provider is a service provider that provides internet services to end users and small businesses and stuff. And they provide access to the internet for their subscribers. And we spoke about the services that they provide last week, such as web hosting, email hosting, e-commerce, iBusiness, and lots of other words that have got one letter and a word stuck on the end of them that sound very internet-y. Okay. Examples of internet service providers are things like, if you're over in the States, AT&T, Comcast, Rogers, those sorts of things. If you're in Australia, we're talking about things like Telstra, Big Pond, iPrimus, etc., etc. And can you please turn our lecture in progress sign around, please? Thank you. Okay. Excellent. We now have an all-new and improved laminated lecture-in-progress sign. It's very flash. Okay. And... excellent. Now, just for anybody in future who wants to know this, sometimes installing AVG can blow away your network stack. So delete all of your network cards and then do a scan for new hardware and your internet connectivity will come back. Just a handy hint there. Look at that. And we're in the lecture theatre.
So that's what did it to me 5 years ago or so.
Yeah, that's basically what probably... Can't hear you. Can anybody else hear Geraldine?
No.
No.
Maybe it blew her audio away as well.
No, I still can't hear you. Yeah. Oh. Oh, yeah, you probably would have it on push to talk, I think. Okay.
Uh-oh.
No, just a humming noise. Is your mute switch turned on, perhaps? Mm-hmm. She missed two trains, her internet connectivity broke, and now her sound setup is hosed. It's all good.
You are having a good day, aren't you?
Yeah, she's having a great day.
Maybe you should go home, Geraldine, and just stop what you're doing.
Yeah, that's right. She'd like that. She'd go home and have a sleep.
Yeah, it's not looking good at this hour, is it? 9 o'clock in the morning?
Okay, internet service provider help desks usually solve business connectivity problems. Why would you pay, can anybody tell me, why would you pay for a business plan from an ISP? And I want serious answers, not flippant ones.
If you needed to host a website and the consumer plan would not let you.
That's one reason, yeah.
And I'll give you an official reason too, even though I'm not supposed to be participating, and that is a higher level of service to the customer.
You can participate if you like. We're not gonna. You're an ex-student. You're allowed to participate.
Thank you.
Yeah. No. Well, certainly, if you're going to say useful things, then we're not going to tell you to be quiet. It's only when you stop saying useful things that we'll tell you to be quiet. Yes, that's right. A higher level of service, and I think I could. And yes, I've noticed that you've said Satish, so you're pending Satish. Give me a second. I'll just finish this sentence. You are correct. A higher level of service. There are people who need the internet for the running of their business, but about the only thing they know about the internet is that when you click on the internet icon thing down the bottom, it pops up Facebook, and when their internet stops working, they need somebody to fix it. And that is what you need the internet business plan for people that need their internet as part of their business but expect an exceedingly high level of support or the corporate version of hand-holding. Also, business plans tend to have shorter turnarounds. In other words, they try to fix your stuff within, a day rather than a week. You tend to get priority, and you can also have different technicians and stuff at different levels that can either come out and do on-site stuff if you want to pay them lots of money, or talk you through all sorts of things on the phone that will help you out. Okay, sorry. No, that's just a very loud hum, Geraldine. An incredibly loud hum.
Geraldine, if you want help, and we move into another channel, I can talk to you if you want.
Yeah, she said that'd be good. So, yeah, you guys shift off into the other channel and you give her a hand or something. We'll see your chat messages, but I'll ignore them. Where'd you go, Geraldine? Just saying. Into Cavi, apparently. Yeah, Cavi? Up the top into the lobby, I think.
Gotcha.
Okie dokie. Sorry, did you want to say something, Satish?
I just wanted to say the answer of the difference between a business plan and that.
Oh, sorry, I think we covered it. Was there anything you wanted to add?
No, there is nothing to add.
Ah, sorry about that. We appreciate the... yep, cool. Okay, let's see. Okie dokie. Now, internet service providers are very competitive. They are basically, there's lots of them, and they're all providing similar services to a large extent, although there is some differentiation between services and stuff like that. And because there is competition, that tends to drive the prices down in the market. And when you drive the prices down in the market, that is a good thing for the consumer. I don't know whether anybody remembers. Does anybody remember back in the early early sort of 96, 97, how expensive internet access used to be?
They were giving away free dial-up internet over here.
They are now, but was it free in 1997?
Oh, yeah, we had Net Zero advertising-sponsored dial-up you could get in 96 or 97, I believe, because my mom had it. And it was terrible.
That's the point. I mean, it depends whether you'd want to actually pay for the services. You need to turn your microphone boost off, Geraldine. That'll fix that. You don't have to drop it that low. That's all right. Yeah, so I remember paying $4 an hour through Microplex. Do you have any... I don't know what other people sort of pay, but yeah, we paid $4 an hour for PPP access. And... we paid 80 cents an hour for shell access. So, quite expensive. Okay, so essentially you're dealing with your price is driven down, you've got competition. If you don't do a good job at being an internet service provider, you will tend to find that people will leave you in droves. And we had a problem when I worked for the ISP in Lismore, where there was only one ISP in town. So when the ISP didn't work, people would bail you up at the supermarket and ask you why it wouldn't work, and you'd be in the checkout line and somebody would run up and go, "Oh, by the way, Todd, the internet's not working." But then once we got more than one internet service provider... we found that there was a lot more competition, and people would just jump from one ISP to another, to another, to another, as I believe people used to do with phone companies. They used to move from one phone company to the other, and they would try and get all of the free deals, and they'd keep trying to get free deals from each phone provider and jump around and jump around and jump around. And I knew people who had like 6 or 8 months of mobile access basically for nothing until the phone companies woke up and kicked them out on the fair use clause. Okie dokie. Now, internet service provider, you have basically three levels of technicians. Level one is your junior technicians. They're the ones that are responsible for answering the phone and saying, "Hello, insert internet service provider name here, how can I help you?" And they sort out the basic problems such as misconfigurations of Windows systems, the viruses that have ripped through your computer and made a mess of it, or the hacks or something that have happened to your computer, that sort of simple stuff. Although, interestingly enough, as an internet service provider, we actually had to draw a very steady line between what was our responsibility and what was the user's responsibility. And we actually said that any viruses that got onto the user's computer were not actually our responsibility. Even if they had got them off the internet, they would have to find other means to actually disinfect and fix their computers up. Continuation of Discovery 2, Module 2. And we're talking about the fact that ISPs, if you don't do the things that you're supposed to do properly, you lose your customers. We're also talking about the three levels of technicians. You've got your junior technicians, which handle your initial problems, such as you and that sort of thing. And I was making the comment that you had to draw a very a strict line between what you are doing as an ISP and what you're not doing as an ISP, and you need to be able to actually specify that in your terms of service so nobody can argue it with you, because a lot of people will argue that if they download something off the internet and they're trashes the computer, that's the fault of the ISP. Bit of a legal grey area there, because whilst the internet was the vehicle of the delivery, that's like trying to blame the postal system for delivering you a letter bomb. I actually heard of one day of a terrorist actually getting killed because he mailed out a letter bomb to somebody and he could put the wrong address on it and it came back to him and he opened it up.
Oh, it's called quality assurance.
Yeah, I heard that.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Okay, so you've got your junior technicians. You've got your more advanced technicians, which are the ones that sort of sit and play network games. No, they don't. They're supposed to do the network planning and look after all of the DSLAMs and infrastructure and that sort of thing. And then you've got the on-site technicians, which are the ones that go out and fix your stuff. And generally in Australia, if you want something installed, like if you want somebody to actually install your ADSL service, you pay somewhere around $100 to $200 to actually have your ADSL service installed, depending on who's doing it and how much you're charging them. I think in comparison, you usually get people coming out for nothing, don't you, Grace, over there in the States? You got the charter bloke to come out for basically not much at all.
We didn't pay them. They just do that for free because it's their equipment, and you just call them and they show up. They're not very good, but they just come do it.
Because if I remember the going rates, if you get a Telstra tech to do your ADSL line, it's like $100 or $200 flat, and then it's like $30 every 15 minutes or something horrendous.
Yeah, it's something like that. I hadn't really checked. I switched ISP a month ago, and naturally just said to like myself, of course, but yeah, they're different places here in Australia. They certainly have different levels of service and different costs.
Well, they figure Americans are stupid and they'll have to clean up our mess anyway, so better just do it.
But I think you guys go on, like, you guys tend to go on contracts and stuff as well, and I think some of the service comes as part of the contract, perhaps, in some cases.
Not for cable and internet, usually. That's usually for cell phone.
Okay. Although, to be honest with you, Elise, if you're switching ISPs, you're probably just doing a churn anyway, so that's a DSLAM issue. If it all blows up, you end up talking to Telstra.
I was transferring between the ADSL 1 to the ADSL 2 infrastructure, so I had to live without the internet for 5 whole days. Yuck. So I went out and bought myself an Optus wireless dongle thingy, whatchamacallit.
As I said, there's three types of death. There's mental death. There's physical death and disconnection from the internet, and the third one is the most unpleasant. Okay, now, what you can also get from your internet service provider is you can get managed services, such as you pay them money to do stuff that you can't be bothered or don't have the skills to do at their place that you don't want to do at your place. So, for example, you can rent a server. and you pay them to manage that server and look after it and stuff. Quite a bit of money usually, but it means that you basically figure out how much you're actually going to pay them for whatever it is, and then you balance that about the what you're supposed to be earning from your business, and hopefully the money you outlay to the ISP is much less than the profits that you absolutely rake in as part of your business. And for some businesses, it certainly is. You put out a little bit of money to your ISP and have them look after a whole lot of your internet infrastructure, and they give you services and you make lots and lots of money. That also means that you can do that with web designers. You basically pay them to care about your site. Well, you pay them to make sure your site looks good and all the links don't break and stuff. And you can either, obviously you can contract them, or you can pay them if you've got lots of money and you've got lots of web work. You can, you know, pay them on a reliable wage, or sometimes you contract them to come in and do some work for a few hours and make your site work. The problems with that is that people are people and they're not as reliable as what we'd like them to be, so a lot of the mess and a lot of the time can be spent when you move from one web designer to another, and you end up having to figure out what the web designer that came in before you did, and then undo half of that work and put in the real stuff that is supposed to go in and actually make the website work and look decent and behave and all that sort of thing. And I'm sure you've done that plenty of occasions, at least.
Oh, tell me about it. Yes, you spend quite a lot of time figuring out what the last people did. And unfortunately, sometimes you've got to bill the customer for that.
Absolutely. The customer pays for that inconvenience. And you work out what they did and you invoice them for, you know, how many ever hours or whatever. My notes just say, note frustrated customers. Okay, that was an interesting thing to write. No, the note actually means how do you deal with frustrated customers? How do you deal with people that have already got their anger level up there, who are already screaming and cursing you down the phone because you are considered to be the bane of their existence? And what you often have to do is... you have to remain calm. You have to pretend that the customer isn't personally attacking you, insulting you, and running you down, which they are, usually. And you also have to work with them as constructively as possible to solve their problems as efficiently as you possibly can, or the people you are working with can. However, there are some customers that if they become too abusive and rude, you have to give them, and there's usually policy for this, a warning or two or three, and if they have not modified their behaviour by the third warning, you inform them that you are hanging up the call, and you hang up the call, and then put a mark next to their account name, which of course you can't sort of officially do, but everybody's got this list of, you know, problem account holders, and you put a mark next to their name to say that that person is somewhat of a problem, and be wary of them if they call back to the help desk. Any comments, questions, stories, anecdotes to go along with that sort of stuff?
Oh, there's quite a number, but I think it might take up the whole lecture, so I won't start.
Fair enough. But I think we could probably summarise it by saying whatever went wrong with the internet is your fault, because you happen to be working on the help desk, and you are responsible for fixing it, and if you don't fix it, then I'm just going to continue to get angrier and angrier, is usually how these calls tend to go, generally speaking. People are happy if they have someone to blame. People are happy if they have somebody to vent their anger on, and that usually ends up being the level one help desk technician.
Yeah.
One of the other things you tend to find is that often the rules and regulations that run a company can be frustrating from an end-user perspective because they don't understand how the company works and they don't know who you're supposed to talk to and what you're supposed to do. They just want their problem fixed. And you often experience this with our social security department. Nobody enjoys calling Centrelink, or at least I haven't met anybody that enjoys calling Centrelink. That'd be scary people indeed. And nobody enjoys calling the tax department or the IRS if you're over in the States. And it can often be a challenge to balance the customer interactions between the customers and the people who are working on the help desk. So be aware of those sorts of things. We could do a whole lecture on help desk etiquette and how you run help desk and all that sort of stuff. I think more of that comes up later in the course, actually. Okay, now, problem resolution methodology. Basically, people want to know how many problems you're solving, what sort of problems they are, whether they've occurred before, how many of them there are, especially for productivity reasons and all that sort of thing. Also, users want to be assured that you're processing their problems to their satisfaction. I'm just going to make sure I'm recording, because... Oh, yes, I am. I'm happy. Okay. And, for example, if you ring up the ISP and you report a problem and you go, well, I'm not able to read email, and then they go, yeah, I'm going to look at that, and then you call back half an hour later and you go, I still can't read email, and they go, email? We don't remember you telling us that. That is one surefire way of getting people really, really upset. So you really have to have ways of tracking these problems and tracking them through the system and stuff and making sure that they're resolved in a timely manner. And you do that with what we call trouble tickets. So somebody rings up and raises a problem with you. You put the problem into the system, which I must personally say, I mean, I understand why they have to do it because I've worked in the industry, but it's really tedious to wait while this person who types at 5 words a minute puts stuff into the trouble system. Has anybody else ever had that?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And you're just and like, I'm sorry, I've got... go ahead, Liz.
I was saying, and you also have to repeat yourself if you happen to ring back to the help desk and get another person and they read through the notes or they have to type in that same note again, you know?
Yes, that's always fun. You get like 6 copies of the one note because you've spoken to 6 different people, and it's all quite frustrating. Now, of course, if you're in Australia and the company is trying to cut costs, you're redirected over some overloaded voice over IP link to a country that you do not know where it's going to go, and you basically have to cross your fingers and hope that the person that answers the phone at the other end of the phone can not only A, understand you, but you can understand them. So a pretty dangerous trend that's going on in help desks and stuff at the moment. They are shipping them out to the cheapest help desk provider, and while some of those help desk providers can often be quite excellent and good and high quality, there's some that aren't and won't and will be, and that's something you need to be aware of, that help desk service will vary wildly all the way across the industry. Okay, you need to have good interpersonal skills, okay? Really goes without saying, but there you go. You've got to have good interpersonal skills. If you're the sort of person that sits in your house and plays Dungeons and Dragons 16 hours a day and never goes out but knows the number to 27 local pizza delivery companies, maybe you're going to have problems with interpersonal skills when it comes to actually talking to people and dealing with people or whatever. So it's very important that if you work in a help desk that you are a very social person, that you enjoy meeting new people, and that you enjoy building a rapport and even if it's a temporary customer-centric focused relationship thingy with people, that you do that when you call them or when you talk to them or when you turn up on site. If you are working on site, you must dress well and present well. Nobody wants a on-site technician that reeks of beer, wearing singlet and thongs, and has bad BO in their office, especially if their office is supposed to be prestigious or has lots of high-paying clients or stuff like that. And it's very important that if you are interacting with the public, that you maintain good personal appearance and good dress standards and good hygiene and all of that sort of thing, because I'm sure we've all had experiences with people who haven't done that, and we've all felt unpleasant memories of those interactions. Okie dokie. Anybody got anything to add about that before I go and revisit the OSI reference model, which is what my notes say here? This is a bit unusual, this bit of chapter 2, but here it is, and I do remember reading through the notes, and they do talk about the OSI reference model, and they talk about how email relates to the OSI reference model, and then we go on and talk about other things. So, any comments on presenting well?
Yeah, I agree with whoever typed that, anyway.
Yeah, it is. I'm going to turn my sensitivity down, because this thing's cutting out in the middle of what I'm saying. Oh, no, I'm not sensitive enough.
I'll tell you a quick anecdote. When I was working for the Department of Premier and Cabinet here in Victoria about 10 years ago, while Kerry sorts his audio out, I was sworn at with just about every expletive you can imagine, really nasty four-letter word ones, by a lady who was so stressed because she couldn't get a briefing note out into the Premier's office before, I think it was 5 o'clock that afternoon. And she, it was about 4:30 or quarter past which time, and she was stressed. I think the Lotus Notes server had gone down again because it was running on Windows NT, and that's what used to happen. So no email and no access to the Lotus Notes databases, and she cursed and swore, and I just had to politely say to her, I'm terribly sorry, I can't do anything about it. The technicians are bringing it up now, and we have to wait for the file system check to occur before anyone can use it. Anyway, she was all full of apologies at 4:45 when she was able to send it back. I must have done something right. She actually took the trouble to ring me back and apologise to me, which was all very nice.
That's really rare.
Well, yes, it would. She's lucky she didn't get me now. After 10 years of running my own business, I probably told her it could take a long jump or something very short if she'd rung me up now, I guess. But I was a bit younger and maybe a bit more pleasant in those days.
And I think this is one of the other things we've always got to, and this is probably worth mentioning, you really have to keep in mind that some of us are going to be technicians on the ends of these calls and putting up with this abuse and all this sort of stuff, and occasionally we're going to be the people who are the end user on the end of the phone calling up help desks. And I think the key thing you have to remember through all of this is that you are talking to a person on the other end of the phone, or a person in the office, or a person in wherever the hell they happen to be. And you've got to ask yourself, how would you like to be talked to? How would you like to be treated in a similar situation? And you possibly need to put on their shoes for a moment, even if they might be a little bit smelly, but you do have to put them on, and have a think about how you would approach the situation if you were in their shoes, and how you would handle that sort of situation. And because what I've often found is people want to express their anger and frustration to someone. They don't care if the person's going to do anything about it. They just want to vent their spleen, so to speak, and they really want to take out their anger and frustration and annoyance out on somebody else, and then they will feel better after it. But then the poor person on the help desk, after they've had 5 or 6 calls of just angry, upset people, might actually consider taking a long jump off something fairly short, because they've really had enough of being abused and belittled and whatever else by all of these customers that that come in and do that. So I don't know, you know, I'm going to get yelled down for this, but believe it or not, telemarketers are people too. And yes, we all love, you know, vilifying telemarketers. And in fact, some of our current students might become telemarketers, so look out. But they are people too.
Yeah, Well, getting back to this lady who I was talking about, she was, and I've seen this happen not just with her, but other people in corporate as well, is that they're under pressure from their immediate supervisor or boss. And back in those days, to be under pressure by the former Victorian Premier wouldn't have been a cool thing.
Absolutely. And I mean, in your particular situation, you just sort of have to take it on the chin and smile and assure them that there's really not much you can do about it and weather the storm, so to speak, and then they'll usually come back and sort those sorts of things out afterwards. But it is a tricky one, and in fact, you do have to be careful if you are working on help desks and level one help desk positions and stuff, that you don't emotionally burn out as a result of it. I've actually spoken to quite a number of people who worked on help desk roles, including myself, and no longer do it because we don't want to put up with that sort of stuff from the users.
Yes, I can well appreciate that, Jerry. In a similar boat to you.
Okay, now there's this thing here that talks about going through the OSI reference model and email as it relates to the OSI reference model. Well, we can do that quickly. I don't see why it actually fits into that portion of the chapter, but that's all good. Level 1 is the physical layer of the OSI reference model, concerns itself with cables, connectors, all that sort of good stuff, voltages and electricity or light pulses. Level 2 is the data link layer, that concerns itself with framing, Ethernet transmission, those sorts of things, point-to-point protocol, etc. Network layer is layer 3, concerns itself with network addresses, logical addresses on the network, whereas the physical addresses are done at the data link layer. Level 4 is the transport layer, which concerns itself with data retransmission, flow control, etc. Level 5 is the session layer, which concerns itself with opening and closing the various sessions. For example, if you open a phone call, talk to somebody and hang up, that's considered opening and closing a session. Level 6 is the presentation layer, which concerns itself with character set conversion, translation, etc. And level 7 is the application layer, which concerns itself with interactions with the end user applications. When you send an email, you type your email into the email application. The email application sends the email through to the application layer. The message then travels down to the presentation layer where the character sets and stuff are converted for the email, for example, encoding binary data into Base64, that sort of thing. Then there is a session layer which we could map to the SMTP transport or whatever, where it opens an email session, sends the messages and closes the email session. We then go down 4 to the transport layer, which is where we look at packet retransmission and retrying and that sort of thing, which ensures that the message gets from point A to point B without any errors or corruptions and that the message gets through safely. If we go down below that, we have the network layer, which is concerned with routing and routing the message across the networks from sender to destination. We then go down to the data link layer, which consists of the physical framing and that sort of thing, the framing of the message and the network level addresses rather than the logical addresses. And then we go down to the physical layer, which concerns itself with the wires, the cables, the optical fibers, the radio waves, that sort of thing. Any questions?
No.
Okay. Suffice it to say, it goes the other way when it goes back up the OSI reference model. Do we want to go back the other way, or will we take my word for it that it goes from physical, data link, network, transport, session, presentation, application, and back to the email client at the other end?
I believe it.
I know. Thousands wouldn't. Okay. That's that done. If anybody has any questions, they can email us and we will go through that. There is actually a longer version of that in one of the previous lectures that we've done where I don't go through it quite so quickly. Now, when you are troubleshooting, the first thing you do is define the problem. What is actually the problem? What is actually going wrong with it? Often you will find that people will ring you up and they believe they know what the problem is. And your job as a network technician is to find out whether you actually find out that that is the actual problem, or whether the problem is something else. And in fact, I know of a particular person, no names mentioned, who thought her internet was down, and it turned out that her cable modem wasn't plugged in.
Seen it happen before with some of my Toastmaster people friends.
Very important to check the physical layer first, followed by the layers above that in the OSI reference model to make sure that things are plugged in, turned on, powered up, connected properly, all of that sort of good stuff. Often you will not check these things and you will ring up the ISP tech support person and go through all the troubleshooting procedure, and then when they finally solve it for you, you feel like a right deal because you possibly should have checked that the modem was on or whatever it happened to be, maybe before you call tech support or... It's all good. No, but plenty of people do call tech support. The first thing they do is pick up the phone and call tech support, and tech support spends a good hour or two with them figuring out that they actually don't have something plugged in, which is all good. And that's part of your job as a tech support technician, to maintain humility while you're working somebody through whether something's turned on or not. Your second step is to isolate the cause of the problem. What is causing the problem? It's not good enough to just say to somebody, I'm sorry, you're running Windows, and hang up on them. That is not going to help them. There are other people who would probably say, I'm sorry, you've got a Mac, and hang up on them as well. It just depends on where you come from. You really don't want to do that. You've got to isolate where the problem is, what exactly is causing the problem. And that can be quite difficult to do. There are various situations where you think one thing is causing the problem, and it tends to be something completely different. We had another problem, and as I said, still no names mentioned, it just these happens to be the ones that I've been coming across. Somebody I know had a pocket PC, and they couldn't get access to the internet, and it turned out that they were connected to a PC and charging, and it was actually ActiveSync that was blocking the internet connection because it wouldn't actually allow them to get to the internet. And I would just like to point out before I get roused on that I have done exactly the same thing myself, and ActiveSync actually blocked my internet connection because it wasn't set to share, and I couldn't figure out why I couldn't get onto the internet through the pocket PC while I was charging it. So unusual things can cause problems, and you need to track down methodically and patiently, and stuff, and a lot of experience helps as well, where these problems happen to be. I don't know whether anybody remembers a couple of weeks ago I thought I had had an intrusion into one of my servers. I thought one of my servers had been broken into. Does anybody remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
It actually turned out that what actually happened was that I was upgrading a few packages on Ubuntu, and it installed a new version of the PAM libraries. And what actually happened was that I hit enter on a question that asked me which PAM modules I wanted, and there was nothing in the box, so it didn't select any PAM modules at all, which then gave me the side effect of being able to SU without a password, and I thought the box had been compromised. It just so happens that if I had actually reconfigured the PAM modules, it would have then prompted me for the super user password, so I didn't actually get hacked after all. Isn't that good?
Oh, good on you.
Wow, that could have saved you so much work.
It could have, but I look at it from this way. It made me change all of my default passwords. It made me reinstall and upgrade the firewall box to the latest version of the operating system with all of the latest security patches. So whilst it did cause a little bit of stress and a little bit of network disruption, it probably wasn't all a bad thing. It probably just wasn't a good idea that I was actually upgrading a whole stack of file servers and stuff at the same time. That made life a little more complicated. But in the big scheme of things, it probably was a good thing to force me to change all of my default passwords and stuff, because I had had the old passwords in place for about 3 or 4 years now. The next step in the troubleshooting process is to solve the problem. That's always helpful. They like it if you solve the problem. It makes them happy, and they might even consider having repeat business with you. So you identify and prioritise alternative solutions, which is what Kieran and I were doing this morning, being the excellent technicians that we are, and modest too. We were giving Geraldine a whole stack of options on what she could do with her computer. We were making sure that we gave her the nice ones, not the ones that we would like to do to the computer. And there were various things that she could... Yeah, and Kieran said it is a Windows box after all. All I can say is I'm not that fond of a Big Mac. We were telling Geraldine what she could do with her computer, in a nice way, of course, and the various things that she could try that would be quick to try and easy to try and resolve her networking problem, and that was identifying and prioritising solutions. We selected one alternative. Well, usually I work through the ones until one works, and then that becomes the one that is the solution we take. And you implement the solution. It's all very well and good to talk about it, but if you don't do anything about it, then the user's still going to have a broken computer.
And if all else fails, you get out the hammer.
Well, you can do that too. Now, you can evaluate the solution. Did it work or not? Yes, it did. So that's all good and the solution is resolved. Or no, it didn't. We need to find another solution. Okay, if the solution that you tried doesn't work, and this is important, undo any of the changes you made where possible, and then look for another solution. There have been a lot of people who try things and try things and try things, and sometimes they don't undo the things they tried, therefore one of the things they tried earlier will actually cause them more problems when they actually do find the solution, and they'll find they'll have to undo some of the work they've done because one of the things that they did broke it worse than what it already was. Okay, there are three ways of troubleshooting problems when it comes to the OSI reference model, and Cisco is very big on this, so you really have to know about it. You can either look for a top-down approach, which is where you start at the application layer and work your way down, application, presentation, session, all that sort of stuff, until you find the source of problem and fix it. Or there is a bottom-up solution, which is where you start at the physical layer and you actually start at the physical layer, look at the data link layer, work your way up the OSI reference model until you find the solution to the problem. Or if you are an advanced technician, you can use divide and conquer, which is where you sort of work from the top and work from the bottom, and if you've got a couple of people working, one of you works from the top, one of you works from the bottom, and you collate all of your information and you find out what the problem is, often quicker than if you work just from one way in the OSI reference model. When you're looking at networking, the first step is to troubleshoot and check whether devices are powered on. It's always a good one. They don't go if they don't have the faster juice running through them. Then you want to check things like hubs and switches and things. Make sure they're powered on and connected and wired up correctly. Wiring a cheap switch into itself is likely to cause it to get very upset because it'll be looping packets back into itself, and that will stop it from working. In fact, we had a wiring loop in here at one point that was stopping a switch from functioning very well at all. Then look at layer 3 network addresses, all that sort of good stuff. Then look at layer 4, which is your IP connectivity, ping, traceroute, etc. And 5 to 7 is application layer troubleshooting. Does Outlook distress work? What's going on with the email program? All that sort of good sort of stuff. You can ping localhost to test your TCP/IP stack. That's something that a lot of technicians tend to want to do. Troubleshoot email and connectivity issues. So what you might do is if the email isn't working, you would then want to see if you've actually got any internet connectivity at all, with a browser or whatever, or another internet application. One of the good ones that I tend to find, and I tend to use it quite a bit, is often if Skype can get a connection and your browser can't, that generally points you at the fact that you've got a problem with your DNS service, because Skype doesn't require DNS to operate. Okay, the other thing we need to talk about is documentation and help desk procedure. Can anybody tell me why is documentation important?
So that you ever have the same problem again, you'll be able to solve it very quickly.
Yes, that's one of the reasons for documentation. Anybody tell me another reason why documentation is important?
So you can use it as reference material. If other people have had the same problem, you can do a search on it and find out whether what they did to fix things.
Absolutely, and that is a very good point, so that other people can look through the documentation and the notes and figure out what the problem is and fix it quickly. And the third thing is so that management actually knows you do some work, because if you've got documentation and stuff there, as far as they're concerned, the help desk people might just sit with a phone on their desk and drink coffee. They might not be sure of how much work the help desk team actually goes through. Okay. The trouble ticket helps on-site engineers know what tools they need to bring. So you can look at the trouble tickets and the documentation for a particular case, and it can often give you an idea as to which tools to bring, what you're going to need, and what type of problem you might be facing. The on-site engineer does the following. He identifies himself or herself to the customer. That's important. Hello, this is Maureen Bloggs from Dodgy ISP Proprietary Limited. I'm here to fix your internet. And they should probably have some sort of identification or a badge or something. You check the trouble ticket with the customer. You make sure the customer is happy with the trouble ticket and make sure that you and the customer agree on what the problem is. You discuss with the customer and you explain to them what you intend to do to fix their problem. Okay, safety first. Ladders work with a partner. That makes a lot of sense, okay? You want somebody to hold the ladder while you climb the ladder. You do not want to be going up the ladder by yourself. And in fact, I have heard stories of painters and stuff who've fallen off ladders when they've been working on their own because they know how to do it all. And they don't need somebody else to hold their ladder, which is, now, the technician checks the solution and makes sure the solution works, and then it is important for the technician to check with the customer and make sure that the customer is happy with the solution and the customer also believes that the problem is resolved. That's all the notes in this module. Does anybody have anything to add or anything anybody wants to say to expand on any of those points? Any questions, comments, anything anybody wants to ask, talk about, any of that sort of good stuff?
Not really. That's pretty self-explanatory, I think, for me at least.
Alrighty, well that's it. End of Discovery 2, Module 2.